Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Announce my first sponsor, Robin Kellison from the Good Seed Company. Welcome, Robin.
Yay! Thank you. I'm so happy to be here and very happy to be your sponsor. We have a large variety of locally adapted, open-pollinated, non-GMO vegetable, flower, and herb seeds. And we hope you'll enjoy visiting our website, goodseedco.net or Good Seed Montana, and seeing the resources that we offer for becoming a better gardener, a better seed saver, and a member of building resiliency around food in your community.
Welcome to the show today. I'm very excited to introduce my guest who I've been trying to kind of get someone from this organization to come on for a long time, and I think we have the perfect person from the USDA's. It's the Natural Resource Conservation Service. A lot of people call it the NRCS. And so my guest today is Andrew Malicelli. Italian must be, right?
Yes.
And you're in Ronan, Montana, which is about, I'm up in Eureka, so you're probably, I don't know, 150 miles south of me.
Yep, about
somewhere that. About that. We're 180 miles north of Missoula. So you're probably, what, 90 miles north of Missoula?
We're about 60 miles.
60, yep. So 120 miles south of me. So welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you.
And why don't you go ahead and just tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. Well, as you mentioned, I work for the NRCS. I'm just going to use the acronym since it's kind of a mouthful. And I've been with the agency for about 10 years now. And as you mentioned, I'm currently working out of Ronan, which is our field office for Lake County. And most rural counties across the U.S. do have an NRCS office located there. So for anyone that is listening to this today, they can surely go to their local office and hopefully get some assistance as well. And with the agency, I'm called a soil conservationist. And basically, I assist farmers and ranchers in the county on conservation-based improvements on the land. So our goal, the agency started back in the Dust Bowl, and we wanted to try and keep the soil from blowing away. Since then, we've kind of expanded our scope, and thus our name changed as Natural Resources, meaning that we'll address any type of resource on the landscape besides just trying to keep the soil from blowing away. And so I, on a voluntary basis, producers will come to us for assistance, and I can provide them technical assistance for free anytime. And then we also have financial assistance programs in addition to that technical assistance to help them sort of achieve their conservation improvements and goals for their particular operation. So that's kind of my NRCS side. And then in addition to that, I'm an organic farmer as well. My wife and I farm, it's called Dancing Boy Farm here in Arlee, Montana, which is about 30 miles south of Ronan, where my office is. And we sell primarily through wholesale. We're part of the Western Montana Growers Cooperative, which there are 42, I believe, farms. And so we don't do farmers markets and things like that, since both of us have full-time jobs off the farm. Being able to sell it wholesale is much easier and fits into our schedule. So we grow a variety of vegetables for the co-op, which then sells them, markets them for us, and then distributes them throughout Western Montana.
Oh, you have to tell me more about that. I never heard of them, Western Montana Growers Cooperative. So how does somebody get involved in that? And how does that work?
Well, not too long ago, some farmers got together that were producing vegetables here in Northwest Montana. And we're wanting to have some additional markets to sell their goods. And so kind of created this co-op of growers. And we became a member, I think this will be our fifth season of the co-op. And basically the co-op sells the produce for us through to local grocery stores, to like the University of Montana, Montana State University, local hospitals, schools, things like that. So they handle all of the distribution and marketing and actually selling of the product. For us farmers, what we have to do is, grow a good product. And we post twice a week what we have to sell. And then the co-op tries and sells it for us. And what they sell, we then deliver at strategic points from Polson down into Hamilton. And luckily, there's actually a drop-off point. We can see it from our farm, so it's quite close for us. And then, they do the distribution.
Wow. So then, is there who does the marketing? Is it one of the farmers, or there's a paid employee, and you all kind of pitch him for that person, or
that
sounds too cool.
Yeah, there's a paid staff. And they handle all the marketing, and we have some of our own trucks. We also piggyback with a couple other distributors to distribute the products, and we sell not only vegetables but also meat and dairy, eggs, things like that. And not necessarily all organic. The majority of us growers are organic, but there are a few that are not organic. But last year alone, we had $1 million in sales, so it's definitely grown quite a bit over the years.
So then, do you have to sell your stuff for a lot less because you're selling it wholesale then? You're still able to make a living that way?
You're right. We do sell it for less. You know, if we were selling at the farmer's market, we might get twice as much. But, of course, you've got one sale day, and you're probably not going to sell everything you have. Sometimes you might. With this, we still make a profit, and we still do well. We obviously save on labor and time to have to, market the product ourselves. And since orders are being combined with all of the other farms, we can produce, especially for us, we farm less than an acre. And we, would have a hard time selling our product to restaurants or grocery stores because we don't have the quantity. Whereas when we combine with our other growers, one box of spinach suddenly becomes 30 boxes of spinach. So it works out really well.
That's awesome. I'll bet other people's heads are spinning as much as mine is, and that thinking that this is a potential way for people to get into, farming that are intimidated by farm. Because I know my husband and I, that's always been our thing. We barely can produce enough for us. We've tried to produce some extra. We have a little bit of extra of this or a little bit of that. But even this year when my husband and I planted the mini farm, it still seems like it wouldn't be enough to go to market or to run a CSA or anything. So that's something maybe we'll have to look up into if there's one going on up here in the north end of Flathead Lake or somewhere down in Kalispell or that area.
Yeah, we do reach up. We do have a couple of farms on the south end of Kalispell, actually, that do deliver occasionally for the co-op and have become members. But it's a really great model. I'd like to see more of it. It's fairly unique. It's definitely unique for Montana.
It is.
They're trying to start something somewhat similar down in the Bozeman area because they have quite a few growers down there. But it's been very successful for us.
I love it. Yeah. I think that's a great idea, a great business model to get to grow and see go all around the country, not just in Montana, but I'm certainly, of course, interested in Montana. Okay, so I do kind of usually start the show asking about your very first gardening experience. How were you? Were you a kid, an adult? Who were you with? What'd you grow? What can you tell us? Are you from Montana?
No, I grew up in Northern California in a suburb of San Francisco, and we didn't do any really gardening of ourselves. I went to the grocery store to get my groceries and really didn't have any knowledge of it. And, I didn't really start growing anything for myself until I was an adult. And really my path towards agriculture was more from an environmental and a health sense than really from a gardening or farming background. I really had a strong environmental ethic, and environmental issues were very important to me, say in my 20s. And I you know, wanted to eventually work in some type of field within the environmental community, whether it was with a nonprofit group or maybe a government agency, which wasn't how it turned out to be. But it was more from the environmental side, not so much from the agricultural side. And then the more thinking that I did on what I really could do to reduce our impact on the land and to improve the environment that we live in, I started to really start to key in on agriculture and private land and private land management. And I kind of shifted from sort of looking at the trees and wanting to save every tree to thinking, you know, where there's a real need for sustainability and where we see the most damage a lot of times. Often it's subtle because you see it over many decades and not, you know, an oil spill or something very sudden, is with our private ag lands. So I went back to school and received a degree in natural resource management and took a lot of ag courses. And that was sort of the path that I wanted to follow. And thankfully, I ended up getting a job with this agency, which, you know, the goal of this agency is to work on help private landowners with sustainability and improve their farming operation and reduce their impact on the land and the environment. So it's, you know, it's a pretty good match, essentially. So from that, you know, I started working with producers down in Bozeman is kind of the area I started in, and kind of started my own garden, just very small, just for myself. And you know, had pretty limited success, as most people probably do with their first gardens, and met my future wife, and we ended up moving up and to our Lee, Montana, where I took a different position with the NRCS, and we bought a couple of acres, and I started working more with those growers that are with the Growers Co-op, and which was really the area I wanted to work in, was organic agriculture. More smaller scale, locally produced, and, you know, something that's locally distributed as well, healthy food, essentially, for local communities. And working with those growers and trying to provide them technical assistance on improving their operation, many times I was learning more from them than they were probably learning from me. And I thought, you know, I think I really want to start doing this on a larger scale. I don't want to just grow our own food. We were starting to grow some more things for ourselves, but I really wanted to do it on a production scale so that I could really learn it and, you know, be able to provide not only the technical experience I'd learned from school and from trainings, but also firsthand experience from doing it on the farm. And it really helps when I'm out there with producers, even when they're not the same type of organic vegetable producers that we are, I'm able to, you know, relate to them much more so than just some government bureaucrat, you know, coming out to tell you what to do. So, you know, it's been very rewarding, and it's been obviously a learning experience as well. I mean, we struggled the first year and struggled the second year and started to figure things out, I'd say, in the third and fourth year. So, it's been a good experience.
Wow. Awesome. Well, tons of golden nuggets there and lots of things to learn and to take in and think about. I really like the way you talk about wanting to, you know, like get your firsthand knowledge so that you could help the people that you were working with better by, you know, understanding where they're coming from and, you know, seeing kind of some of their challenges as well as what they were, you know, I guess being successful with, like, just being able to understand their process better by having your own place. So, yeah.
And, you know, I want to kind of tie that back in. I was just thinking, you know, when we decided to start farming on a production scale, we probably would not have been as successful or been able to really do it for, I mean, this will now be our fifth season, which isn't a long time, but given that it's a side portion of our work, we obtained a contract with the NRCS and were able to put up a high tunnel, a 2,200 square foot seasonal high tunnel, and we were able to get financial assistance to put in a drip system, both for our field crops and for our high tunnel, which is all automated. So when I'm at work, it can be irrigating, my other job. And we received financial assistance to do some cover cropping on our place, both in the tunnel and out in the fields. And we did some soil sampling with financial assistance. We planted, I think, 120 trees and shrubs around our field borders to improve habitat for pollinators and beneficial insects. And all that was with, you know, some financial assistance. Your tax dollars are helping to basically get our farm, you know, up and really running a lot quicker and a lot quicker to be profitable and productive than it probably would have been otherwise. So it kind of gives you an idea of what is available out there for producers that are interested, even when they're as, you know, as small as we are. I have producers I work with that are like me that are farming an acre, and I have some that have 10,000 acres. And, yep. You know, the one thing with our agency is that we're size neutral. So any of the project that we work on, it doesn't matter really the size. As long as you're producing something for market, then, you know, you can qualify for some of our assistance.
So when you say producing something for market, like, do you already have to have like a business plan and customers and things like that? Or
it's a little different with our agency. You don't, it's not like a grant process. So you're not having to put a proposal in or show a business plan or show financials or any of that. Basically, you set up your farm with the Farm Service Agency, which is usually co-located with us. And what that does is put your farm on the map and you tell them what you produce. And it doesn't matter if you don't produce a lot or if you maybe just donate all the food that you do produce, or maybe you just have a couple of cows and you're not really, you know, it's not your primary source of income, that's fine. You can still qualify to receive technical and financial assistance from us, basically because you are producing a, you know, an agricultural product, whether it be, you know, one cow or 1,000 cows. It essentially qualifies you, since you are growing on the land and you are having an effect on your environment. That's something then that we can, you know, hopefully help you out with.
Really? Excellent. All right. We're going to have to look into that. So, and then one of the other things I was looking into is like, is there a special thing for veterans? Cause my husband's a veteran and I was looking last night and I saw like, is that a different thing or?
Well, for our programs, that we do have some additional benefits if you are a beginning farmer, meaning that you haven't farmed for 10 consecutive years, or for veteran farmers, or for those that have been previously disadvantaged, socially disadvantaged, we call it. Minority groups, things like that. And basically, there's a couple of different benefits, I guess, in our programs. Sometimes it can increase the amount of cost share or the amount of payment that we'll give you for an individual practice. We don't pay 100% of what the cost is. We just pay a flat rate that is usually less than, you know, what the total cost of it would be. So there's more, you know, buy-in on your side. And then for veterans, that their particular benefit right now is they have their own their projects will get ranked ahead of other projects. So they get a little bit of a ranking priority when it comes down to project ranking. Because basically it's a competitive process. So if you do apply for our assistance, your project will be ranked against all the other projects in the county. And basically the more conservation that we're getting on the ground, the higher your project will rank. So if we're not really helping you out a whole lot, or there isn't a whole lot for us to help out with, then your project will probably rank low and you probably will not get funded, versus if you are interested in really addressing a lot of resource concerns on the land, you know, your project will more bump ahead. And before I forget, I just wanted to mention, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast now versus later is we do have a deadline coming up on the 19th of February, and it is for organic growers. And it's also for those that are interested just in putting up a seasonal high tunnel and just doing a few things within the tunnel, like cover cropping within the tunnel or adding a drip system in the tunnel, but it's rather narrow. Our organic program has a whole host of practices. That was the program we used, and we're able to do, you know, a lot of things both in our row crops and planting trees and doing – soil sampling, cover cropping, as well as doing the tunnel. So we kind of have two programs that are having a deadline coming up that, you know, folks are interested in getting some financial assistance. I mean, our technical assistance you can get anytime you walk in the door, but we do have these deadlines that come up once a year for program funding.
Okay. So let me just make sure I'm understanding that. So this is for anywhere in the United States, right? It's not just Montana.
Correct. Anywhere in the U.S.
And they just would go to like the NRCS's website, and I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's the Natural Resources Conservation Service, and go to the website and they'll find a link to the Organic Farmer Program. Is that what they want to look for?
Yeah, you know, they can go to our, you know, it's a government website, so it's kind of a sea of information. You can go to programs and kind of work your way over to organics. I think the easiest thing to do, it shows there, find your local office and find out where your local office is in your county. Just about every county across the nation has got an NRCS office, and just walk in or give them a call and find out, you know, what you need to do. The application literally takes about 2 minutes. It's mostly your name and a few check boxes on kind of what you're doing, and then you sign the end of it. And the thing with our programs that most people don't realize, again, differing from a grant type program, is that most of the paperwork is done by your NRCS agent, and you don't really have to do a whole lot besides, you probably have to sign a lot of things, but you don't have to do a whole lot of other additional paperwork, and everything else is kind of handled behind the scenes by whoever is assisting you with your, you know, at your local office.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay, now I do have to ask like one question probably other people are wondering, like you kind of compared it to a grant. So like if you get one of these high tunnel systems, do you have to pay that money back? Is it just a loan till, and that's what I'm curious about.
No, it's a payment. And that, again, another difference with a grant is that first you would get a contract. Second, you would purchase and install a high tunnel. Third, the NRCS conservationist would come out and take a look at it, make sure it meets our standards and specifications. And if it does, then we would pay you, which would be a flat rate payment for that particular high tunnel or particular practice, wherever it may be. If you're putting in a drip system or putting in a livestock tank, we pay a flat rate for that particular practice, as we call them, and you get paid at the end after you've done it, regardless of what the cost is to you. So, you know, you would know up front when you signed your contract, which can be up to 6 years in length, so you don't have to do everything in 1 year. Oh. And so you would know what you would be getting, but you would have to, you know, initially, like with a high tunnel, you'd have to purchase the high tunnel or finance it some way, mm-hmm. and then you would have your payment after you had installed it.
Nice. But still, that's just amazing that you can. And that's kind of how I found out about you, was one of my guests talked about getting their high tunnels through you. It was Ron Hansen, I'm pretty sure, who used to live up here. And he was the first one. And then I went down to that Lower Valley Farm. They had a tour down there, which is the one that's probably one of the ones you're talking about, maybe that's in your growers cooperative. I don't know. But they're just north of Flathead Lake. And they had gotten their high tunnels through the program. And I met, what's his name? Is it Angel?
On Hill.
Yeah, there. And I think he's the one that connected us.
Yes.
So seeing what they had done, too, was amazing. And that's, you know, one thing we would be interested in is getting a high tunnel to kind of extend our season and help. But who knows? My husband might be interested in a lot of those things. Mm-hmm. He's kind of more the gardener. So, okay. Well, do you want to tell us what organic gardening or earth-friendly gardening means to you?
Sure. I guess, well, for one, you know, organic is really a term and a label. So I guess it's kind of what's behind that. And I kind of look at organic certification and as a sort of a bar, it's kind of a minimum bar of, you know, following organic standards, which entail crop rotation and having good soil management practices and having habitat for beneficials and wildlife habitat. Some of it is, I'd say, somewhat vague. and there isn't concrete levels of how to measure that. And, you know, for me, I would say organic, assuming that you know the grower, so I'll say organic on our farm is growing without the use, of course, of prohibited substances. We don't use any insecticides at all. There are organic insecticides you can use. There are organic herbicides you can use, and we don't use any of those. So, you know, for us, we're trying to grow more as a system and more in tune with nature. And I think that's kind of what I'd like to see in organic agriculture, and which I often see in smaller growers and maybe not so much in kind of the larger, more corporate run organic farms, whereas they might be just meeting sort of that minimum bar standards. Whereas I think if, you know, on our farm and the growers that I know, and I think that goes into knowing who your grower is. And if you get the opportunity to do a farm tour, that's even better, to learn kind of firsthand how they're growing. And if they are kind of growing or trying to grow more in balance with nature and not be fighting nature with tools that are not very sustainable. We don't use a whole lot of tillage on our farm. We try to limit that. And we utilize cover crops in a rotation so that there's something growing most of the year on our fields. And I see that with other growers as well, and that have had good success with that, of utilizing cover crops and utilizing living roots to, you know, as part of a biological system. I guess that kind of leads me to not just what organic means to me, but more of what ecology means, and more agroecology and looking at agronomic systems and how to grow food for sale in a way that is more in balance and is less laborious for us and has less inputs, outside inputs especially, I would hope.
You were saying, no, you were getting the part I'm most interested about, because we just got 4 sheep. And so
Perfect.
The livestock part, you said, we don't have any livestock, kind of the missing key is where I lost you.
Right. Yeah, I think that is the missing key on our farm and for a number of vegetable producers or even just crop producers in general, whether it's organic or conventional. We're kind of missing that livestock component that we historically used to have. So instead of having livestock providing nutrients back to the land, we have to truck those nutrients in. And it doesn't matter if you're a small place like us where we're bringing in fertilizer, or you look at, you know, a giant cornfield in Iowa, you know, that is still has to, you know, import those nutrients onto the farm. So I think that's kind of a missing component. And if, you know, that would be the one area that I'd like to see us maybe someday get to, whereas we do have some livestock, be able to utilize those to graze our cover crops that we do, so it provides them, you know, with their feed, as well as they'll be able to then return that back to the land, and we'll be able to have more of a closed loop on our farm and not be relying on any sort of outside inputs.
Yep, that's exactly what my husband's goal is. So who or what inspired you to start using organic techniques? Was it like growing up in California, your family that way? Or like you said, you were kind of like had some strong environmental roots.
Yeah, you know, it really was more on the environmental side. I ended up, I don't remember what video I saw, but I saw some video about the meat industry that disturbed me enough that I became a vegetarian for, I don't know, a year or a year and a half. And it really kind of keyed me in on what is going on in our agriculture that, and I had like no idea, and this was my early 20s, as to, you know, what was the common farming practices out there. And, you know, that really sort of woke me up, and it made me then do some more research and reading about how we grow our crops and how that affects, you know, nutritionally. For ourselves. And so I think really from that environmental and nutritional standpoint, and still really not having a lot of knowledge myself at the time, the easiest way for me to feel like I was mitigating some of what I was seeing was to key in on certified organic products. And so I then, you know, sought out where I could find and basically everything that I purchased, I wanted to make sure it was going to be, you know, certified organic, or if it was from, you know, a farmer's market, I wanted to make sure that that grower was organic, or, you know, was following organic standards, and I could ask them about it. And, you know, even though I didn't really know what all the organic standards meant at the time, I just thought, oh, it means they're not, you know, spraying any chemicals on things. I didn't really, you know, fully understand the scope of organic agriculture and how there's actually additional benefits beyond just that in terms of the landscape and in terms of the environment and in terms of wildlife and things like that. So, yeah, it really was more on environmental and health side than anything else.
Okay. So then how did you learn how to garden organically? Was it at school or just from trial and error at your place, or?
Well, I think, you know, part of it was in school because, you know, later on I did go back to school and took ag courses and I spent a little bit of time on an organic farm and kind of learned a little bit more about what it meant. And then I just read the standard, the organic standard, yep, to kind of see what it all entailed. Because when I started working for the NRCS and I was interested in organics and I thought it was important and I was using my purchasing power for organic, I wanted to know more about what it really meant, so that if I was going to be working with producers and be discussing even, you know, transitioning to organic, because I do have producers that have transitioned while I've been assisting them, I needed to know more about it. You know, we're not a certifying agency, the NRCS, we're not a regulatory agency. That's not anything that we do. But I really felt it was important to understand, you know, what it really meant. So I went to the standards, I read, you know, fact sheets and things like that, to really kind of gain that knowledge and that background. And then I think, you know, later on when we did our organic systems plan for our farm, which you need to do, you know, to be certified organic, going through that systems plan, really then I could key in on what is required and what is, you know, behind the organic standards, essentially.
Okay. Well, I guess, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
You're going to your list of questions.
Yeah, I just, I was going to ask something, but then I thought I'll just stick to my questions.
Well, you know, for us, it's taken us a number of years, but we've kind of figured out what grows well on our land and what fits well in our schedules. Yep. For, you know, since we both work full time, we really need to find crops that, you know, like I said, that fit into that type of a schedule. My wife's a teacher, so she's off in the summers and she does, you know, the most of the farming in the summer. I do most of the farming on the shoulder seasons in spring and in fall. And so for sale, you know, we probably grow 6 or 7 different crops that sort of fit in that, you know, particular schedule. So they've all, last year, they all did well, except for the only crop that we didn't do well was the peas. And that was because we had 100 degree weather in early June and they just sort of fried on the vine.
Yeah.
So, you know, everything else, like I said, did well this past year. What we tried to do last year was to focus a little more on ourselves and grow some crops. I mean, we always grew stuff for ourselves while we were growing stuff for sale, but we wanted to do more of that. And so, unfortunately, although we put more effort into expanding our personal garden, the grasshoppers decided that they liked that too.
Oh,
and
no.
Yeah, we had a epidemic of grasshoppers out here. I've never seen it like the way that we had it. And they were just strip plants to the, you know, the stem. So the crops that we grow for sale turn out to not be very palatable to grasshoppers. So we didn't have anything that hurt us for the co-op and what we obligated to sell through the co-op. But for our own personal crops, it was a pretty sad year again. So we'll just have to try again this year.
Oh, no. Oh, so are you going to tell us what the crops that you grow for the co-op are?
Well, we've kind of narrowed down to in the spring, or actually I'll be working in the tunnel in a few weeks getting it planted, but in the spring and in the fall we do green leaf head lettuce. And basically what we'll do is we'll cover crop half of the high tunnel with peas and oats starting in a couple of weeks. And then the other half of the high tunnel we'll do in head lettuce, which is pretty manageable for me because I'm doing most of the farming this time of year. Mm-hmm. And then come May or so, we'll be harvesting that head lettuce. And then I'll terminate the cover crop and we'll put in cherry tomatoes. So my wife does pretty much all the cherry tomatoes during the summer months in the tunnel. And then once we pull up that lettuce, I'll cover crop that half of the tunnel, which will be in head lettuce again come September, early September for our winter crop. So we'll do head lettuce twice and the cherry tomatoes in the tunnel. And then outside in our field crops, we do primarily three different types of summer squash. We do a patty pan, a zucchini, and a crookneck squash. Wow. And then we do peas. So that's pretty much our crops that we do for sale. And most of those, you know, like with the cherry tomatoes and with the peas, they're upright, so they're very easy to pick. We're not doing a lot of bending over. You know, it's just the two of us farming, so if we can reduce the labor on things, it's helpful. Same with the squash. You know, squash are very easy to harvest. You know, the varieties we choose don't have a lot of spines or anything, so it's easy to harvest. And well, the head lettuce is fairly simple as well. We don't have to do – we used to do spinach, loose leaf spinach, and it required, you know, double washing and drying, and it was just – took too much time for me, especially on the shoulder seasons when, you know, I'd be out there with a headlamp, you know, working to wash and rinse and dry, and it was just too much. So with the lettuce, we can just go in. I can harvest it in the morning before I go to work and deliver it on my way to work, and it just fits really well for us.
Awesome, Andrew. I think a lot of people are going, wow, I didn't know that I could have a, you know, profitable farm with just, you know, those few things and not have to plant like, you know, green beans and carrots and potatoes and what's the other one that I'm always just flabbergasted by? Green beans, potatoes, I don't know, radishes, like, you know, just like everything under the sun that you can just pick these certain crops, and especially that you're picking, because I always like things to be convenient. Like, ever since I've had deep beds and I don't think I could ever go back the other way where I can just sit on the edge of the bed and weed or harvest to go back to kneeling in the ground. I can't see that ever happening. Although my husband's new little mini farm is not like that, but yeah, I think that's important. And I think that's great that you have that all planned out. And then I like the part about the cover crops and changing them. I am curious, like, how come just green leaf head lettuce and not red leaf head lettuce?
Well, because we grew a variety and it did well. And so we thought, well, let's just do that again. So, yeah, you're right. It's a little more nutrient dense to do a red leaf than a green leaf. But and I'm always trying to look at nutrient dense varieties and you know, look at.
I didn't know that. Nutrient dense, because the red leaf is more nutrient dense than the green leaf.
Typically, yes. There's, you know, between varieties, the nutrient density of the crop can vary quite a bit. So I thought that's why you were suggesting to do red leaf instead of green leaf.
No, that's the one that I tend to buy when I go to the store for some reason. But
okay. So, you know, and that kind of leads to, for us, and I would suggest this to anyone, you know, you just got to find what, especially if you're just starting out, what works on your land and what you can do in your schedule. And I mean, we tried a lot of different crops and we had failures and things that didn't work, or we harvested very little and ended up not selling any because it was such a small quantity or it didn't meet standards. I mean, we still have to, you know, the American public wants everything to look beautiful. So, you know, you have to grow good looking crops. And for us, the crops that we've kind of narrowed down to, we're able to grow well and they do well here and they don't require a lot of work now. We've kind of got those figured out. And so, I think that's really important that you should find out what works on your place and then, you know, grow a lot and grow it well.
And the other thing, like the tomato thing, because we can grow cherry tomatoes really well, but like getting a regular size tomato to turn ripe at our place, no. I think if we had the high tunnels, it might make it a little easier, but just being able to just focus on cherry tomatoes would be really nice.
Right. And, you know, with the way the growers co-op works is there's a seniority system. So there's already a lot of growers that are growing nice, beautiful, round tomatoes. So where there was an opening for cherry tomatoes, that's where we decided, oh, maybe we'll try that and see if it works. And it did work for us. So, you know, that's kind of dictated as well for some of our crops has just been that there's an opening where there isn't really any growers doing it or there's not enough growers growing a particular crop. If it was, if we went in and asked the co-op to move, you know, 2,000 pounds of bell peppers, that they wouldn't be able to do it because they already have enough growers that have been doing it for years and doing it well that have seniority over that. But all that is decided actually this time of year. We do planning, so we know, we let them know what we want to grow. They let us know if that's going to fit and work out, and then we grow it and they sell it. So, you know, there isn't really too many surprises, you know, during the growing season. We already know our six or so crops that we grow, they're accepted that they're going to sell again for us. And so we can move forward with it.
Awesome. So I was thinking that I had interviewed two other people from down in Arlee, Roy Mills and David Wolverton. Do you know either of those guys? I know David grows a lot of tomatoes. And Roy is a baker. He owns like a German bakery down there.
Oh, sure. Yep.
So,
yes.
And they had some great tips on growing tomatoes, especially David. Although I guess his crop got pretty wiped out last year. But I really like that growers co-op model. Oh, it was Sarah Harding in Whitefish who has this place called is it the Buggy Road Farm, and she, and that's kind of what they did after, you know, selling at the farmer's market for several years. A lot of people told them that their asparagus was kind of an open niche that could be filled, and that if they grew asparagus they wouldn't be able to grow it, they would be able to sell like every ounce of asparagus they sold. So they started doing asparagus I think last year or the year before. And so they're getting into that because they asked around. So that, I guess that's what I was trying to get at, that it's really good to think about what, you know, looking for your markets. I just love this growers co-op idea. That's just the greatest thing. Okay. So how about something you're excited to do this year? Is there something you're excited to try new? You're just focusing on your own personal garden more? Is that
I think I'm going to hope that the grasshoppers come in cycles and we'll have a better year on our own crops. I think kind of what I mentioned a little bit of is just the nutrient density of food. That's been something that has been a new interest of mine. And so I've tried to been selecting some things to grow for ourselves that are known to be varieties of that are higher nutrient density type things. So I'm kind of excited about trying some of those things and you know, seeing how they do on our farm.
Awesome. Well, I don't really guess I know much about that. So like certain lettuces have a higher nutrient density. What other things do? Or I mean,
some of them are pretty easy because a lot of times, you know, the things that are more colorful, like purple carrots tend to have higher, you know, nutrient density than orange carrots.
Really?
Yeah.
I just saw some purple carrots in the store, but they didn't look very good. But this friend, Megan Keane, who's been on my show, grew some really yummy looking purple carrots. Her pictures of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it just seems like
I'm
some
gonna
of
have
the,
to try that.
The things that are unusually colored, even the purple, like the, have you seen the black/purple tomatoes?
You know, we have those for the kids at school. Like the little, they're like little tiny grape tomatoes.
No, these are full size tomatoes.
Oh, no.
There's some varieties out right now and they're pretty phenomenal in terms of, you know, what is packed inside of them. So, you know, if you look at, we'll say like iceberg lettuce versus like a romaine lettuce or the red leaf you said before, there's way more nutrients in those than if you eat the iceberg lettuce, which is basically nutrient. Right. There's nothing in it but water.
Right.
So, but within certain, you know, other types of crops, there's quite a bit of variety in terms of what you're getting out of it. Oftentimes, you know, the larger the produce, the less nutrient dense it is because it's more water. You're actually not getting as much nutrients as you might get from something that's smaller. So small onions tend to have more nutrients than large onions. So, looking at growing varieties that are not necessarily known to be huge, giant producing, crops tend to have higher nutrients. And then actually that kind of gets me just thinking back at the organic side is, you know, what you put on the ground and what you grow in the ground that is, you know, what we're consuming, and those nutrients have to come from somewhere. So, you know, when you're growing organic, oftentimes you're using, you know, more natural fertilizers that are going to have more than just basic nutrients in them that you would otherwise get from a, say, a conventional place. And so our food can tend to be higher in nutrient density when it's grown organically or grown, you know, especially, you know, if there's livestock integrated with having cover crops and things like that. You're going to have much more nutrients in the soil for that next crop to take up, which we, you know, ultimately eat. So it kind of goes back into that cycle that I was talking about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Okay. Do you want to tell us about something that didn't work so well this season? What was you planned?
Well, I told you about the peas because of the heat. So we're going to try and seed those a little bit earlier. We seeded them a little bit late last year. So that was part of it was our own fault. You know, we don't have real good luck with things like kale and broccoli and cabbage. We get a lot of pest pressure on those.
Oh.
So that's why we don't grow them. We grow them for ourselves. We don't grow them to sell because we just have too many pests. So, you know, I'm going to try this year. I bought some insect netting to place over them. And so I'm going to give that a try and see if I'm able to kind of improve those crops because they've just really struggled for us pretty much every year. And they're things that I really like. So I want to try and improve on those.
Okay. We're going to try to grow more broccoli this year too. I told my husband over and over, we can never have enough broccoli. And I'm going to try, this is my first year I'm ever going to try to grow kale. I've never grown kale, but since I've done my show and people have talked about it so much, mm-hmm. Of course I was going to try to put in last summer and never did, but this summer I think I already have my seeds. How about something that you find is easy to grow and generally successful every time?
Well, I would say summer squash, but the funny thing with summer squash is when you grow just a couple of plants, they do great. They do really prolific. That's, you know, the typical home garden has a giant sprawling, you know, zucchini plant. And so I'd say, you know, those are usually pretty easy and foolproof. The funny thing, though, is that when you try to grow anything and you go from a backyard, you know, your own personal garden scale, and you try and ramp that up, you really discover there's some additional challenges. So even like with growing rows of zucchini, we had a little bit of, you know, our yields weren't all that great the first year for sure. So, you know, there's still a learning curve, but I would say that, you know, squashes are, for the most part, they're pretty foolproof, and they're definitely foolproof for, you know, a home garden, whether it's zucchini or crookneck or the patty pans. We've had really good luck with patty pans, but the patty pans we didn't do the first year when we were new novice growers on a larger scale. So they might have benefited from a little bit of our knowledge of farming, but they've done exceptionally well for us and been very low maintenance and produced a long time.
And they're good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, my experience with them is that they store better too. They just last longer in the fridge. You know, they don't get soft and mushy like a zucchini will. It might just be that they've got a little bit thicker of a skin and they don't seem to be, they're a little bit denser, I think, than zucchini.
I think you're right about that. How about something you'd steer new gardeners away from that you find is typically challenging to grow in your climate?
Well, those few I mentioned before, just because of pest pressure, you know, kale, cabbage, broccoli, those guys just seem to be pest magnets, even when you don't. I mean, we're kind of surrounded by pasture here, and I don't know where the bugs come from, but they find it. And so, you know, those are pretty tough. Some of the warm season stuff can be difficult if you don't have some sort of covers or shelters. You know, if you're doing sweet peppers or eggplant can be tough. You know, tomatoes can be tough some years if you don't have something to be able to cover them with and shelter them or get them going early enough so that you are able to get, you know, tomatoes before we get a hard frost. And the same with, you know, with peppers. So, you know, some of those just take, definitely have to have more effort, you know, put into them. And for those that are pest prone for your area, you know, be conscious of that and think of, you know, ways to be able to mitigate that. And, you know, for us, I don't have enough time to sit and pick all the bugs off the cabbages, but like I said, we're going to try some type of a cover, a netting type thing. And there's things you can spray on those crops that are organic, but, that's just not something that I'm really interested in doing. So, I think that's kind mm-hmm. of the been the challenging ones that we have seen.
Yep. We've had really tough time with cabbages though. The last 2 years we've finally gotten some, knock on wood, that we haven't had as big of a pest problem. I don't like that, the idea of those organic pest things that they say. They just sound too, I don't know. Anyway, which activity is your least favorite activity to do in the garden? Is there something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
That's a tough one. You know, I kind of enjoy each aspect in a little different way. We farm basically three seasons, so we're kind of doing, like whether it's field prep, we're doing a little bit of field prep three times a year and doing a little bit of seeding three times a year. So I don't ever feel like I get too overwhelmed by it. We kind of have it staggered in stages so that there isn't really anything I can think of that I really dislike. I guess the only thing, most of the time I'm okay with weeding. The only time I don't like weeding is occasionally we'll just get grass, we'll just dive right in, and all of a sudden, especially with new seedlings, we can't find the seedlings because there's just so much grass. We have some pretty invasive grasses around here, so I think that would be more of a frustration. General weeding doesn't really bother me. I don't feel like we do a whole lot of weeding in general. We're not necessarily all that afraid of having a few weeds, but I think maybe the grass invasion would be. So definitely doing a good job with field prep and keeping a watchful eye out for some of those grasses to just suddenly creep in and all of a sudden I can just take over, would be probably my least favorite.
Okay. I like that answer because I think that's inspiring to people that there's lots of people out there that pretty much like it all. And that I think that's something other people have said, that as long as it changes a lot and I'm not doing everything for a very long time, the diversity in the jobs.
Right.
How about your favorite activity to do in the garden? What do you like to do the most out there?
That's tough. I'd say first off, I think of just delivering sometimes. It's just there's a lot of satisfaction knowing that what we produce and the healthy food that we produce is going out into the community. So I think part of that, just that satisfaction of doing that delivery, and it's kind of a culmination too. Every time I deliver, I do most of the delivering, and I just, from taking it from, seed to final product and then delivering it and seeing it go out, it's kind of a bit of a satisfaction on that end for sure. So I think, definitely eating the produce, of course, would be up there as a favorite thing. I like to cook a lot. And so that's definitely would be high on the list. That's a tough question because there's, harvest, delivery, and of course eating it probably be the top three.
Excellent. You're the first person that's talked about delivery. and I like all the parts about it.
I think part of it is our first year was such a struggle, and sometimes we had so little to deliver. It was sad, that all you're delivering is like a pound of spinach, and sometimes we wouldn't even bring it over there because we can't. I wouldn't even want to walk in with just here. All I've got is this pathetic pound of spinach. So now that I think we're actually delivering a fair quantity of goods, that it's more satisfying and feels like we're actually providing some benefit to the local community.
Awesome. Andrew, you're going to be like one of the most inspiring people that's been on my show. I can just tell people are like, I can do this. It's going to be tough. It's been tough. No wonder, but I can get there. What's the best gardening advice you've ever received? This is the tough one. I think when my friend Lisa interviewed me, this was the one I got stumped on.
The best advice?
Yeah.
I think the best advice is a couple things. One is every year is always a little different. So you can't always predict what's going to happen.
That's good.
So you really have to be flexible and accepting for what happens in nature. And you can't fight it. And you're going to have times when certain crops are going to do great and others are going to do terrible. And you're going to have more of that the first few years, especially if you're just getting over that hump of starting to grow for a product for market, I think that you just have to be able to accept that everything's not going to go perfect. There's not even going to be one year where everything works out great. It just doesn't happen in agriculture because you're working with nature. And so we can't control it to that degree that we know that all 10 or 20 of our products are going to be exactly at the yield that we want. There's always going to be something out there. So I think, you know, knowing at the beginning that you're going to have a lot of struggles, knowing that every year you are going to have some struggles, but they're going to get easier and you'll get more flexible and you'll start to see some real results, assuming that you just keep at it and keep at the idea that you want to work with nature and not try and work against nature. And so you want to try and steer that environment by using cover crops and using natural methods and fertilizer and things like that, steer it to where your crops are doing really well and reduce that risk for you and reduce your stress level and even ultimately reduce the amount of work that you have to do.
Awesome. Perfect. Do you have a favorite tool that you like to use? Like if you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
I think my favorite tool is probably a Hori Hori. Mm-hmm. It's a, you know, a Japanese sort of spade. And it's great. It's been really durable. It was one of them that I lost the first one I had, and we found it like 6 months later out in the field, and it had been, you know, buried under snow and mud and everything else, and it's fine. You know, it's a steel blade, and it has a it's a really simple, not a very expensive tool, really common in Japanese gardening, and it's just super versatile. I mean, I can weed with it. I can use it for seeding. I can use it to harvest. So I think that's one that would definitely be on me most of the time that I would, you know, be out there.
Cool. Yep. I had no idea what one was till I started my podcast, but a few people have recommended them, so I've seen them now. How about, do you have any tips for eating or harvesting vegetables or fruit on time? Like, that's always my big struggle, is that everything comes on at once.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to be pretty versatile with your recipes. You know, and we don't really, I'd like to someday, but again, it comes down to time, and we've got a lot of hobbies and things besides just farming. So, we don't do canning. We do a little bit of drying, and, most of the time we'll just do freezing. And so, you know, that's pretty simple stuff to freeze. You know, some things you can just freeze without even having to blanch or anything, you know, like cherry tomatoes or peppers, hot peppers, things like that. You can just pretty much throw in the freezer. So that stuff's, you know, again, we're kind of looking for the easy way out there. We don't have a whole lot of food waste, surprisingly. I think, you know, for us, I'm able to give a lot of stuff away. If we can't sell it and we don't eat it, we have enough avenues to be able to give away our crops. And then a number of the crops we grow for ourselves are more storage type crops that do well in Montana, winter squash and you know, onions and garlic and things like that, which are very easy to store. But I mean, you're right. I mean, there's certain things we grow that, you know, are really only good certain times of the year. And part of it for us is we do a decent job. I mean, we could obviously do better, but we try to eat more in season. So we just take advantage of the time that we have certain things and, you know, eat them when they're in season and then adjust as we go. And I mean, we're by no means anywhere near where we should be, but we definitely make an effort of eating in season and enjoying it when it is in season. Because believe me, we get really tired of squash when it comes to be the end of September. You know, we've been having a lot of squash. you know, we're happy to not have squash for a few months. So I think that might be part of it too.
Okay. How about, what's your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden then?
Favorite recipe. I really enjoyed this last summer. It was new for me, was to make spaghetti out of zucchini. So, you know, using like a julienne and julienne the zucchini and making it into a pasta dish. That's been something new and a good way to utilize all that zucchini that we end up having. So that would be up there. And then the other I would say is I always like to do like roasted vegetables. So, you know, anything we have, I can just about throw in with some olive oil and some garlic and roast it for a long time and add it to pizzas and pastas and things like that. So I would say roasting ends up being, you know, a really versatile way to use a lot of our things that I really enjoy.
Okay, I just have to ask, when you say you're making a pasta dish with zucchini, like in the sauce, or you're actually making the noodles out of the zucchini?
I'm making noodles out of the zucchini.
You are?
Yeah. So you just like cut off both ends, and if you have a julienner, you can just run down it. They even have, you can buy a device to make it into like noodle shapes. But yeah, that's all I do. And then just saute it up a little bit and a little bit of olive oil for a couple of minutes just to kind of warm it and to soften it down and make it, use it as any other type of pasta that you normally would do. And it's a whole lot healthier.
I was just going to say that must be so much healthier. I love that. Awesome. I'm going to have to try that. I've never done that. Okay. And a julienner is just kind of like almost like grating it or into strips.
Yeah, kind of strips into like strips or like matchstick, you know, long matchsticks. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Do you have a favorite internet resource? Somewhere you go to find stuff about working in your garden?
I think a really good source is Atra. Are you familiar with Atra?
Just since I started the show.
It's a sustainable agriculture nonprofit, and they're out of Butte. They're nationwide, but they happen to be based out of Butte, Montana. And their website has a huge number of guides, free downloadable PDFs on just about everything you can imagine on sustainable agriculture. A lot of it organic, but a lot of it really just based on sustainability. And the other really good resource I think that they have is they have an Ask a Farmer line. So you can actually call in and ask your questions to their experts essentially, or you can email in questions and they'll get back to you. And so I think it's a great, easy resource to get questions answered. And they are really knowledgeable on what they're talking about. So that's been a really good one. The other one I really like is, and it's not as easy of a website to navigate, but eOrganic's pretty good. And, you know, eOrganic puts on a lot of webinars that I think are great. There are a lot of archived webinars, and they kind of have a similar thing as Atra. They have an Ask an Expert area where you can email a question and they'll get back to you in a day or two. And you know, you can ask them just about anything you can imagine. And I've used it before, and it's been helpful. So I think those two are probably ones that are pretty good sources for just about anybody.
So can you like mail them a picture? Like we had this prune tree that died one year, or not a plum tree. And it was like going to be our best crop ever. And it was so full of these yummy looking delicious prunes. And like overnight, they just, not prunes, plums. Overnight, it just died and they just shriveled up into nothing. Like, could I send them a picture of that? And could they tell us maybe?
I think you can. You know, the other resource that would be good for that is your local extension agent. Most, you know, counties have a MSU extension agent, and they would be able to direct you on where to take that, or they could even, sometimes they'll send a sample to the lab there in Bozeman and be able to get back to you a more definitive answer. But I would definitely direct you towards that. You could definitely try the Ask an Expert or the Ask a Farmer and see if they've seen it before. And sometimes they'll just refer you to someone else that you can, you know, forward that picture to. But it could be just as easy as talking to your local MSU extension agent.
Okay. Do you have a favorite reading material, like a book or a magazine or a blog or anything that you like to?
In terms of magazines, probably Acres magazine is, I really like. It can be both frustrating and rewarding at the same time. There's definitely articles I think they delve into, and it's very interesting. And then there's times where it's basically a farm tour and doesn't really tell me too much. But so I would say that would be one magazine that I look at. In terms of books, I like Elliot Coleman's books. I've read a couple of his and have them on the shelf and occasionally refer to those. And, you know, he does a lot with season extension and, It uses movable tunnels and row covers and has a pretty good environmental ethic and crop rotation and explains things in a simple manner, I think, in his book. So I'd probably say that would be my pick.
Okay. I just got a bunch of his books out of the library. I've been reading them this winter a lot. Definitely have learned a lot. Okay. So as far as like business advice, do you want to talk about your business? Do you want to tell us a little more about the NRCS? Is there anything that you skipped there? I mean, you have been full of like, if you're tired, we could be.
getting there, but.
Anything that we've forgotten to mention?
No, I think for business, and I think most people know this, but I actually get surprised sometimes when I work with producers. Make sure you've got a market for what you want to grow before you try and grow it. I've worked with producers, and it seems surprising to me that they'll grow a product and they assume that it will sell, and they maybe don't know the marketplace, and maybe they don't know that it's already flooded with a whole bunch of this particular product, that maybe they grew a great crop, but there just isn't a market for it because it's not set up. So I think, you know, kind of knowing beforehand, I guess that's with business planning and things like that, is there a market for what you want to grow? Or maybe find out what is missing in the market that you can grow, especially if you're planning on doing it not at a farmer's market. If you're planning on doing a farmer's market, sure, you can grow whatever the heck you want to grow. And assuming you're not in Missoula where there's 50 other growers growing tomatoes, you know, you'll probably be able to have some sales. But if you're trying to look at moving into markets that are, say, restaurants or private institutions, then I really think you should probably be making some phone calls and knocking on some doors and saying, hey, what do you need? You know, what would be something that would be great for you to have in a reliable, in a decent amount quantity wise of a particular product before you go delving into a certain operation.
I don't know. You know, until I started this podcast, like now that I've been doing this for a year, I've been thinking, you know, that's the way to go about it. But until I started doing this, I wouldn't have thought that either. I would have always thought, well, you got to have a product before you go talk to people. But now I realize that, no, the way to go is exactly what you're saying. Go ask the restaurants, is there something that they would be interested in, or is there something that they would want? And what is it? Ask them first and then figure out how to grow it.
Right. And I think too, I wouldn't put all of my, all my cookies in one basket. If I would want to talk to enough people, and if I heard the same thing two or three or four times, be like, okay, there really is a need for this. I wouldn't want to, this person says they're going to buy, 1,000 pounds of tomatoes from me at the end of the year. I would want to make sure I had a backup plan too, where it was like, yeah, there's a few people that are interested in this. So I know that, I've got something to fall back on, or if we want to expand, I know there's still growth in that particular marketplace. And because you never know, people say they want something today and then they decide, they change their mind. And here you are now with baskets full of something. So, having a few people, I think, where you start to see a little bit of a trend, and a lot of that information you might be able to find online or talking to other growers or neighbors or things like that, and learn kind of where there is maybe some opportunity for growth. Like you mentioned before with asparagus, where there is, I hear that too, that there's probably in certain markets, there's some opportunities for asparagus. So maybe that's something that would be, that you could try growing.
And the other thing, like I've heard you're one of quite a few people have talked about selling to the universities, but I've always thought the schools. But I think what I should do, the thing to do would be to talk to the schools, actually call them, reach out to the people that work in their lunchrooms, or find out who is it that makes those buying decisions and would they be interested? And could you, because I always thought, I told my husband, I was like, I bet we could if we just sold carrots and potatoes to the schools, that would make but before we do it, we should probably talk to them and find out, would they even buy them? Right. What do they need? How many pounds do they actually go through? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing I've wondered about is where would you store them all?
Yeah.
So I think that's great advice that you said. And I know it may seem surprising to you, but I think a lot of people think, you got to start with a product before you go sell it, instead of starting with a market and then coming up with the product for the market.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here's my final question. Ready?
I'm ready.
If there's one change you would like to see Andrew to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about, or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale? It's kind of a doozy.
I think really is, I'm not going to put a name out or a particular organization. I think understanding the need for growing our food in a more sustainable, ecological fashion. And right now, at least the only name that we have that can give us some assurances that it's being grown in that sense is with organic. But I think there needs to be more of a demand, and there's been an increasing demand over the years for products that are grown more sustainably and ethically and humanely. And I think we need to continue that, and we need to continue to educate ourselves and understand how these systems work and how growing in an ecological way is not only good for the environment and makes us feel nice and warm and fuzzy, but it also is feeding our health. And what we are seeing in terms of diseases and our own long-term health and feeling good about ourselves and feeling good on a regular basis, it comes back to what we're eating and where it comes from and how it's grown, whether it's the cow from the feedlot or it's the carrot out of the field. Where it's being grown and how it's being grown affects us all, whether we like it or not. And so I think understanding that and hopefully gaining a little better understanding of how we grow our food and what choices that we make, I think that's going to be a real key ingredient to our species' future, essentially, is having adequate food and nutrition and enough land to grow it. And hopefully we're starting to see that by having better farming practices, we're able to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. You know, it all kind of ties back together, and it all ties back down to the soil and the soil health which leads to our own health. So it's all, again, it's kind of it's ecology, and it's something that I hope that more people will be interested in and be advocates for and demand that things are done in a more sustainable fashion.
Perfect. Okay. Do you have an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden?
A motivational quote?
Or a tip or just something, anything.
Well, I think you really only know what you're putting in your body if you get out there and grow it yourself. So if you grow that carrot on your own, you know what went into it and you know where it came from and you know how you got the product and how it was delivered to yourself. And so you can kind of take that global food conglomerate down to your backyard and feel pretty good about it.
Excellent. And I think that kind of goes along with what you were saying in the very beginning about if you were going to help the people that you were working with, you kind of had to understand where they were coming from. And so if people kind of grow one piece of food, they're going to understand a little bit more about all the food that they eat.
Right.
Okay. Do you want to tell people how to connect with you if they have any questions?
Sure. You can reach me through the NRCS, and it's basically my name. It's Andrew.Malicelli. And I assume you'll have that on your site, how to spell that. And it's at usda.gov. And I think you could probably Google my name and put USDA, and it would probably come up that way as well. I'm out of the Ronan field office, so you can surely call our local office there. I've helped people basically actually all over Montana. I've had calls from folks all over Montana. I've visited farms all over Montana and helped people out, especially with organic agriculture and with vegetable production. So it's kind of a bit of my specialty now. So I'm always willing to answer questions and try and provide as much assistance as I can.
Andrew, thank you so much for sharing with us today. You were just full of tons of great inspiration and knowledge and just lots of things, I think, to make people be successful. I really think you're going to help people be strategically successful and think about different options that they maybe didn't know about or different ways to do things. And I think you made a lot of people's brains spin in the right direction today.
Well, good. It's been enjoyable, and I hope it is worthwhile for everyone.
Thanks. Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to check out our website, organicgardenerpodcast.com. That's just organicgardenerpodcast.com. And you'll see the links to everything that we've talked about today in the show notes page and all the other episodes there. You can easily search for people by name. You can download our ebook on organic gardening basics and subscribe to our newsletter for updates and just different things that are going on. Thanks for listening, and remember to grow.